Chapter 42. Too full of adventure, to be briefly described, there is no month in the whole year in which nature wears a more beautiful appearance than in the month of August. Spring has many beauties, and May is a fresh and blooming month, but the charms of this time of year are enhanced by their contrast with the winter season. August has no such advantage. It comes when we remember nothing but clear skies, green fields, and sweet-smelling flowers, when the recollection of snow, and ice, and bleak winds, has faded from our minds as completely as they have disappeared from the earth, and yet what a pleasant time it is. Orchards and cornfields ring with the hum of labor, trees bend beneath the thick clusters of rich fruit which bow their branches to the ground, and the corn, piled in graceful sheaves, or waving in every light breath that sweeps above it, as if it wooed the sickle, tinges the landscape with a golden hue. A mellow softness appears to hang over the whole earth. The influence of the season seems to extend itself to the very wagon, whose slow motion across the well-reaped field is perceptible only to the eye, but strikes with no harsh sound upon the ear. As the coach rolls swiftly past the fields and orchards which skirt the road, groups of women and children, piling the fruit in sieves, or gathering the scattered ears of corn, pause for an instant from their labor, and shading the sunburned face with a still browner hand, gaze upon the passengers with curious eyes, while some stout urchin, too small to work, but too mischievous to be left at home, scrambles over the side of the basket in which he has been deposited for security, and kicks and screams with delight. The reaper stops in his work, and stands with folded arms, looking at the vehicle as it whirls past, and the rough cart horses bestow a sleepy glance upon the smart coach team, which says as plainly as a horse's glance can, "It's all very fine to look at, but slow going, over a heavy field, is better than warm work like that, upon a moldy road, after all." Apostrophe you cast a look behind you, as you turn a corner of the road. The women and children have resumed their labor, the reaper once more stoops to his work. The cart horses have moved on, and all are again in motion. The influence of a scene like this was not lost upon the well-regulated mind of Mr. Pickwick. Intent upon the resolution he had formed of exposing the real character of the nefarious Jingle in any quarter in which he might be pursuing his fraudulent designs, he sat at first taciturn and contemplative, brooding over the means by which his purpose could be best attained. By degrees his attention grew more and more attracted by the objects around him, and at last he derived as much enjoyment from the ride as if it had been undertaken for the pleasantest reason in the world. "Delightful prospect, Sam," apostrophe said Mr. Pickwick. "Beats the chimney pots, sir," apostrophe replied Mr. Weller, touching his hat. "I suppose you have hardly seen anything but chimney pots, and bricks and mortar all your life, Sam," apostrophe said Mr. Pickwick, smiling. "I warn't always a boots, sir," apostrophe said Mr. Weller, with a shake of the head. "I was a vaginer's boy, once." "Apostrophe, when was that?" "Apostrophe," inquired Mr. Pickwick. "When I was first pitched neck and crop into the world, to play at leapfrog with its troubles," apostrophe replied Sam. "I was a carrier's boy at startin', then a vaginer's, then a helper, then a boots. Now I'm a gentleman's servant. I shall be a gentleman myself one of these days, perhaps, with a pipe in my mouth, and a summer house in the back garden. Who knows? I shouldn't be surprised for one." "Apostrophe, you are quite a philosopher, Sam," apostrophe said Mr. Pickwick. "It runs in the family, I believe, sir," apostrophe replied Mr. Weller. "My father's worry much in that line now. If my mother-in-law blows him up, he whistles. She flies in a passion, and breaks his pipe. He steps out, and gets another. Then she screams worry loud, and falls into hysterics. And he smokes worry comfortably till she comes to a gin. That's philosophy, sir, ain't it?" "Apostrophe, a very good substitute for it, at all events," apostrophe replied Mr. Pickwick, laughing, It must have been of great service to you, in the course of your rambling life, Sam. Apostrophe, service, sir, apostrophe, exclaimed Sam. You may say that. Arter I run away from the carrier, and afore I took up with the vaginer, I had unfurnished lodgings for a fortnight. Apostrophe, unfurnished lodgings? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick. Yes, the dry arches of Waterloo Bridge. Fine sleeping place within 10 minutes' walk of all the public offices, only if there is any objection to it, it is that the situation's rather too airy. I see some queer sights there. Apostrophe, ah, I suppose you did, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick, with an air of considerable interest. Sights, sir, apostrophe, resumed Mr. Weller, as I'd penetrate your benevolent heart, and come out on the other side. You don't see the reglar vagrants there, trust 'em, they knows better than that. Young beggars, male and female, as hasn't made a rise in their profession, takes up their quarters there sometimes. But it's generally the worn out, starving, houseless creatures as roll themselves in the dark corners o' them lonesome places, poor creatures as ain't up to the twopenny rope. Apostrophe, and pray, Sam, what is the twopenny rope? Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired Mr. Pickwick. The twopenny rope, sir, apostrophe, replied Mr. Weller, is just a cheap lodging house, where the beds is 2 pence a night. Apostrophe, what do they call a bed a rope for? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick. Bless your innocence, sir, that ain't it, apostrophe, replied Sam. When the lady and gentleman as keeps the hotel first begun business, they used to make the beds on the floor, but this wouldn't do at no price, cause instead o' taking a moderate twopenn'orth o' sleep, the lodgers used to lie there half the day. So now they has 2 ropes, about 6 foot apart, and 3 from the floor, which goes right down the room, and the beds are made of slips of coarse sacking, stretched across 'em. Apostrophe, well, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick. Well, apostrophe, said Mr. Weller, the advantage o' the plan's obvious. At 6 o'clock every morning they lets go the ropes at one end, and down falls the lodgers. Consequence is, that being thoroughly waked, they get up very quietly, and walk away. Beg your pardon, sir, apostrophe, said Sam, suddenly breaking off in his loquacious discourse. Is this Barry St. Edmunds? Apostrophe, it is, apostrophe, replied Mr. Pickwick. The coach rattled through the well-paved streets of a handsome little town, of thriving and cleanly appearance, and stopped before a large inn situated in a wide-open street, nearly facing the old abbey. And this, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick, looking up, is the Angel. We alight here, Sam. But some caution is necessary. Order a private room, and do not mention my name. You understand? Apostrophe, right as a trivet, sir, apostrophe, replied Mr. Weller, with a wink of intelligence. And having dragged Mr. Pickwick's portmanteau from the hind boot, into which it had been hastily thrown, when they joined the coach at a Tanswill, Mr. Weller disappeared on his errand. A private room was speedily engaged, and into it Mr. Pickwick was ushered without delay. Now, Sam, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick, the first thing to be done, is to apostrophe order dinner, sir, apostrophe, interposed Mr. Weller. It's very late, sir. Ah, so it is, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick, looking at his watch. You are right, Sam. Apostrophe, and if I might advise, sir, apostrophe, added Mr. Weller, I'd just have a good night's rest arterwards, and not begin inquiring arter this here deep until the morning. There's nothing so refreshing as sleep, sir, as the servant girl said afore she drank the egg cupful of laudanum. Apostrophe, I think you are right, Sam, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick. But I must first ascertain that he is in the house, and not likely to go away. Apostrophe, leave that to me, sir, apostrophe, said Sam. Let me order you a snug little dinner, and make my inquiries below while it's a getting ready. I could worm every secret out o' the boot's heart in 5 minutes, sir. Apostrophe, do so, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick, and Mr. Weller at once retired. In half an hour, Mr. Pickwick was seated at a very satisfactory dinner, and in three quarters Mr. Weller returned with the intelligence that Mr. Charles Fitzmarshall had ordered his private room to be retained for him until further notice. He was going to spend the evening at some private house in the neighborhood, had ordered the Boots to sit up until his return, and had taken his servant with him. "Now, sir," argued Mr. Weller, when he had concluded his report, "if I can get a talk with this here servant in the morning, he'll tell me all his master's concerns." "How do you know that?" interposed Mr. Pickwick. "Bless your heart, sir, servants always do," replied Mr. Weller. "Oh, ah, I forgot that," said Mr. Pickwick. "Well, then you can arrange what's best to be done, sir, and we can act accordingly." As it appeared that this was the best arrangement that could be made, it was finally agreed upon. Mr. Weller, by his master's permission, retired to spend the evening in his own way, and was shortly afterwards elected, by the unanimous voice of the assembled company, into the taproom chair, in which honorable post he acquitted himself, so much to the satisfaction of the gentlemen frequenters, that their roars of laughter and approbation penetrated to Mr. Pickwick's bedroom, and shortened the term of his natural rest by at least 3 hours. Early on the ensuing morning, Mr. Weller was dispelling all the feverish remains of the previous evening's conviviality, through the instrumentality of a halfpenny shower bath, having induced a young gentleman attached to the stable department, by the offer of that coin, to pump over his head and face, until he was perfectly restored, when he was attracted by the appearance of a young fellow in mulberry-colored livery, who was sitting on a bench in the yard, reading what appeared to be a hymn book, with an air of deep abstraction, but who occasionally stole a glance at the individual under the pump, as if he took some interest in his proceedings. Nevertheless, "You're a rum un to look at, you are," thought Mr. Weller, the first time his eyes encountered the glance of the stranger in the mulberry suit, who had a large, sallow, ugly face, very sunken eyes, and a gigantic head, from which depended a quantity of lank black hair. "You're a rum un," thought Mr. Weller, and thinking this, he went on washing himself, and thought no more about him. Still the man kept glancing from his hymn book to Sam, and from Sam to his hymn book, as if he wanted to open a conversation. So at last, Sam, by way of giving him an opportunity, said with a familiar nod, "How are you, Governor?" "I am happy to say, I am pretty well, sir," said the man, speaking with great deliberation, and closing the book. "I hope you are the same, sir?" "Why, if I felt less like a walking brandy bottle I shouldn't be quite so staggery this morning," replied Sam. "Are you stopping in this house, old un?" The mulberry man replied in the affirmative. "How was it you weren't one of us, last night?" inquired Sam, scrubbing his face with the towel. "You seem one of the jolly sort, looks as convivial as a live trout in a lime basket," added Mr. Weller, in an undertone. "I was out last night with my master," replied the stranger. "What's his name?" inquired Mr. Weller, coloring up very red with sudden excitement, and the friction of the towel combined. "Fitzmarshall," said the mulberry man. "Give us your hand," said Mr. Weller, advancing. "I should like to know you. I like your appearance, old fellow." "Well, that is very strange," said the mulberry man, with great simplicity of manner. "I like yours so much, that I wanted to speak to you, from the very first moment I saw you under the pump." "Did you though?" "Upon my word. Now, isn't that curious?" "Worry singular," said Sam, inwardly congratulating himself upon the softness of the stranger. What's your name, my patriarch? Apostrophe, job. Apostrophe, and a worry good name it is. Only one I know that ain't got a nickname to it. What's the other name? Apostrophe, trotter, apostrophe, said the stranger. What is yours? Apostrophe, Sam bore in mind his master's caution, and replied, my name's Walker, my master's name's Wilkins. Will you take a drop o' something this morning, Mr. Trotter? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Trotter acquiesced in this agreeable proposal, and having deposited his book in his coat pocket, accompanied Mr. Weller to the tap, where they were soon occupied in discussing an exhilarating compound, formed by mixing together, in a pewter vessel, certain quantities of British Hollands and the fragrant essence of the clove. And what sort of a place have you got? Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired Sam, as he filled his companion's glass, for the second time. Bad, apostrophe, said Job, smacking his lips, very bad. Apostrophe, you don't mean that? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Sam. I do, indeed. Worse than that, my master's going to be married. Apostrophe, no. Apostrophe, yes. And worse than that too, he's going to run away with an immense rich heiress, from boarding school. Apostrophe, what a dragon. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Sam, refilling his companion's glass. It's some boarding school in this town, I suppose, ain't it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, now, although this question was put in the most careless tone imaginable, Mr. Job Trotter plainly showed by gestures that he perceived his new friend's anxiety to draw forth an answer to it. He emptied his glass, looked mysteriously at his companion. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.